Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Sponsored by Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by CyberTrust.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business number 27 for Tuesday, August 21, 2007. On today's show, we'll catch up with Adam Boileau, aka MetalStorm. He's been a researcher with securityassessment.com in New Zealand for some time now. Now, he recently resigned and will take up a position with Dave Vitale's company ImmunitySec. But today we're talking to Adam about his role in organising the new Australasian hacker conference KiwiCon. Some of you may have heard of RuxCon or even been to it. That's the annual HackerCon in Sydney. Well, it's not running this year, so MetalStorm and some of his mates have thrown together another conference, KiwiCon, which will take place in November this year in Wellington. That interview is coming up shortly. We'll also hear from Verizon Business Security Solutions' Andrew Valentine. Unbelievably, Valentine says many companies in the United States are getting owned through web content management systems that have been deployed insecurely. And I do mean insecurely, no passwords, the whole deal. And if you thought that the worst you could do with control of a CMS is to deface a few pages, you're in for a nasty shock. That's coming up later. First up, though, we'll check in with ZDNet Australia editor Minia Katadia for a check of the week's news. This week, we're looking at that mysterious 48-hour Skype outage, which the company insists was not the result of a denial-of-service attack against its limited centralized infrastructure. We'll also chat about the recent compromise of servers belonging to Ubuntu distributor Canonical. The company says Ubuntu downloads were not affected. Denials have been vehement. But let's get Minia on so we can start chatting. Minia, it looks like this storm worm is just refusing to go away.
No, that's right. It's amazing. We kicked it off. We first noticed it around January time, wasn't it, when it was going around in greeting card emails as an attachment. And since then, it's changed and evolved. But no, it keeps coming back. Yeah. We're just about to put up a story saying that between May and August, they reckon 20 million people have been infected by it, and it's come back again. It's just had another resurgence in the past week.
20 million, do you believe that? That's like the entire population of Australia.
I know, it's kind of scary.
It sort of puts it into perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I suppose, look, if you're a malware writer and you're on a winning thing, why would you change it? If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Well, you know, it's funny, though, because we haven't seen too many of these really massive things, have we? And this one's actually, when you look back on it, it's like, oh, actually, it's a real big deal now.
Yeah, it's sort of crept up. And it's sort of funny how you've always got the malware companies saying, oh, well, you know, malware is all about small targeted attack these days and spear phishing and fnaf, fnaf, fnaf. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, yeah, well, here's one that infected 20 million people. So, you know, I don't know that they've quite... And I think it's a real failure of the AV and anti-malware industries that they haven't been able to prevent the spread of this thing because it keeps morphing. They keep, you know, changing it so that it slips past filters and AV.
Is this one of these ones that was made with a kit?
I don't know, actually, with the Stormworm. I had McLeonard Starkey from Auscert on the podcast a couple of weeks ago talking about Storm, and it was news a few weeks ago that it hadn't gone away.
Yeah.
And it looks like it's resurgent again.
Yeah, because one of the things I've heard about quite recently is when they're creating them with a kit, you know, some of the antivirus companies, there's one in particular, Kaspersky, was saying that it's kind of made the virus authors a bit lazy, you know, and a bit predictable. Because they go to their kit, you know, and they pick their little features that they want for their malware and then send it off and it morphs away and it does quite well. But because of this, you know, once the antivirus companies get into this and they realize, hang on, the kit's creating this, it makes it easy for them to track. But it doesn't seem to have helped them if this one was.
So are you actually sitting here longing for more innovation in malware?
I'm not saying that, no.
Now, an international identity theft ring targeted Texas billionaire Charles Wiley Jr., which is a great Texan name if ever there was one.
It's just what you expect, really, yes.
Yeah.
I think it made the news because they took 12 million, or tried to anyway.
Yeah, well, I love this guy's name, Igor Klopov. He's 24. Guess where he's from? He's Russian. And he's been accused. And I love the way he selected his targets. He picked their names from the Forbes 400 list.
Well, that's a good start, really. There's a contact list if you ever want one.
There is a tech angle here in that he used his home computer to retrieve their property records and mortgage information from online databases. But yeah, they got busted when he wrote a $7 million check made out to a gold dealer near New York City before the fraud was discovered.
He was doing so well until then. I mean, you know, he was like, he got this, he got the right list, he got the right people. He's obviously like, you know, gone in there and then uses his home machine and writes a check for $7 million.
If you're going to rip someone off, right, you're never going to be morally in the clear, but about as close to morally in the clear as you can get. If you're going to rip someone off, it better be a billionaire Texan oil tycoon, you know.
Yeah, I'm with you there. Okay.
You hearing me? You know, he's not stealing from the Red Cross. But nonetheless, still caught and facing up to 25 years in prison. So message to any potential miscreants out there, don't dabble in ID fraud because you'll go to prison. Skype, for those of you who haven't heard, Skype dropped for 2 days. People were unable to log on, which made it very annoying for corporate users who really rely on the Skype service for business purposes.
Yeah, there's more and more people that are using it, and it was quite a big deal that they went down for 2 days. I got to say, I didn't really notice. I only use it as an emergency thing or when I'm really, really being cheap and don't want to pay for any calls. It's the problem, though, isn't it? It's when you get used to this service and it's just always on. I mean, what if Google went down for 2 days?
I've always thought that would be quite wonderful because, you know, that I'm just sick of all these stupid people out there thinking they're smart because they've got access to a search engine. So I just love Google and Wikipedia to go away for a few days.
Oh dear.
You know, it's like it's made trivia competitions really sort of boring, isn't it? You know?
Oh, it has a bit. Yeah, everyone's got their little PDAs now under the tables and stuff, haven't they?
Yeah, no fun. But look, yeah. I mean, Skype has been pushing into the enterprise. And look, I mean, this thing, regardless of whether it was a distributed denial of service attack, the fact remains that it could have been, you know, and this has become a service that's become very important to a great deal of corporate users. One interesting thing to note is that the Skype clone on my Mac machine was actually crashing during this. So
that's right. Yeah, you told me about this. What was going on there? So it wasn't a service. It was actually the client.
Well, that's what they say. There was a flaw in the client, in the actual, in an algorithm somehow. So it was some really wacky problem. But yeah, I definitely noticed it crashing on my side. I mean, you know, it could have been a worm for all I know, but obviously, you know, security types would have picked that up on their sort of packet sniffing boxes all over the planet. But it was a very weird error. But the thing is, you know, Skype has made a bit of a play for the business market. I don't know if you recall this, Mania, but around January this year, there was a bit of a junket floating about for a few journalists to go to London to see a demonstration of Skype being used by some businesses over there.
I remember laughing at this and saying that they're going to fly these people all the way over there to see how this voice over IP telephony thing is making travel.
Yeah, well, a junket is a junket is a junket. And, you know, it was January. It was the middle of bloody summer. The surf was really good. And I got offered to fly over. And it would have been great, you know, flying over to London, spending a week over there.
To use a VoIP phone.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't it? It's a bit of an ironic twist. And also, London's just such a pit, especially in oh, sorry, mate, I know you're from there. But it's,
you know. No, that's why I'm over here, mate.
But, you know, it's like a week in London in the middle of winter or another week in Australia in summer. So, yeah, easy choice. Definitely spending money trying to get the word out that Skype is ready for business, and then this happens. So it's, yeah, probably a bit of an embarrassment for Skype and its mother company, which is, of course, eBay.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing about this is it's a good job that, you know, I mean, eBay, they've bought this, and I guess they're going to integrate it within their marketplace and auction sites, etc. Imagine if it went down and it had these issues. Once that happens, that could cause all sorts of trouble for them.
Yeah. Now, Canonical has dismissed Ubuntu security concerns, even after some Canonical servers started attacking other systems.
I haven't been able to get the full details on this. I can't understand what they mean. Their servers attacked other systems.
Well, I guess that means they were being used as a, you know, midway point in some sort of an attack. Someone had hacked into those boxes and were using them to start, you know, going after CIA boxes or something.
Okay, and this wasn't the servers that they use for the service, they say. It's not a problem with our production servers.
No, their local community, somewhat appropriately called Loco, hosted services. So they've basically put out all these press statements saying, this is not a problem with our production servers. Loco servers that we pay for but that do not sit in our data center with a problem, and blah, 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 blah. But basically they're saying that Ubuntu, I think the concern was that someone might have hacked into the code repository and, you know, trojaned the absolute crap out of Ubuntu, which would be bad news.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it doesn't look like that's actually happened.
Well, they're completely denying it.
Yeah, yeah. Although, you know, you got to wonder if they do protest too much.
Yeah, so we've got the marketing manager, can I say, the company, a guy called Jerry Carr, and he is saying it has nothing to do with downloaded copies of Ubuntu. It is separate servers on a separate network in a separate location.
Mm. Any imputation, and there has been some, that this episode has or had any bearing on our enterprise readiness. I love that wanky buzzword in there as well.
Or the marketing, right?
Yeah, that's right, marketroids. Or the Ubuntu downloads is so completely wide of the mark as to miss the point entirely, he said. My lord, I mean, methinks the marketroid doth protest too much.
But, I think you could be onto something there.
But look, we'll just see. They might be in the clear yet. Now, of course, Adobe's come out and said, you know, Adobe said PDF spam is not a threat, but they would say that, wouldn't they?
Because, they would too.
They make Adobe.
It takes up your bandwidth and is a real nuisance. Is it a threat? Well, I mean, it depends what you mean by a threat, really. You know, is an advert sending you offering you Viagra, is that a threat? It's just annoying.
Yeah, well, I guess the other thing to note is that, you know, PDFs are no more dangerous than any other attachment, but, you know, attachments are just bad news. I mean, you can, any single bit of software that resides on your system, you open up, you know, you figure out how to screw with that file format well enough and you're going to start exploiting stuff.
I think saying that it's no more dangerous than any other attachment is just a blatantly stupid statement. I mean, let's just go back to the Stormworm again. That started spreading because it was an attachment in an email, and that's where we've seen so many of these other threats come from. So it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can load up Word documents, PowerPoint slides, PDFs, whatever, with malware. So I think, you know, the real question is if you get a PDF, you know, in your inbox from someone you don't know or you're not expecting, don't open it.
Yeah, but what do you do if you're the HR director of a company and it's somebody pretending to send their CV through in a PDF file?
That's a very good point, actually. I never thought about the poor old HR directors. They'd have to open up a lot of malware, wouldn't they?
They would. They'd have to open. They've got to be like a prime target. I think that's got to be one of the most dangerous jobs here.
Yeah. Maybe they'd have some sort of, you know, demilitarized zone just for the HR guy to open up all of the skanky resumes.
That's true, actually, yeah. Leave him out in the open there, get him to open this stuff, and once he realizes, oh, it's safe, oh, it's not, okay, then move him in.
They need their own VLAN.
Yeah, it's a good plan.
Yeah, cool. Now, this does have a bearing on security to an extent, but Citrix has agreed to pay $500 million for ZenSource, so it looks like they're about to go into competition with VMware. Now, this means we're just going to see virtualization absolutely bloody everywhere.
I thought it was everywhere.
Well, it is, but now the interesting thing about Citrix making this deal, right, is you've got VMware rolling out their VDI stuff, which is virtual desktop infrastructure, which means they provision access to individual operating systems running in a virtualized environment over thin client, okay? Mm-hmm. So not like using a normal Citrix box or a terminal services box where you've got multiple users accessing one operating system. These guys access, you know, their own OS running as an image.
Yeah.
So, you know, it looks like by Citrix buying ZenSource and their sort of hypervisor technology, they're going to be offering this very similar sorts of services. So it looks like we're going to see an absolute boom in, you know, the popularity of thin client. This is something I've been suggesting for a while. I mean, whether or not it materializes is, you know, something else, but
do you reckon it's safer to go the thin client way and with all of this? I mean, it's all fairly new and they're putting it all together. How much of a threat do you think it really is?
Well, it depends who you talk to, you know. I did an interview, a completely different interview to the one we've got on today's podcast. Today we're speaking to Adam Bailu from securityassessment.com, but I think several months ago I had a chat to him about RDP and some of the really nasty things you can do with RDP, like mounting drives over thin client protocols and all sorts of stuff. So, you know, it's just, it's unfamiliar territory for a lot of system admins, and that's when you start making mistakes, and that's when you start getting security problems. So that's why I pulled this one out for today's news. It just looks like, guys out there, you know, start reading up on thin client, because you're going to start seeing a lot more of it.
They're going to leave lots and lots of doors open.
Yeah, well, we don't know. I mean, you know, they might actually develop the tools. You know, Citrix made a big play to sort of tag themselves as a, you know, security company. instead of being, you know, purely a provider of thin client solutions. But yeah, we're just going to have to wait and see if they provide tools to the enterprise market to enable them to deploy this stuff securely, because there's so much of it going up and, you know, it's not a typical enterprise deployment. So we're just going to have to see if admins start making mistakes and leaving some gaping holes out there for everyone.
Yeah, we're going to have to check this one out. I'll keep an eye on this one for sure.
Okay, Munir, thanks for joining us this week.
It's been a pleasure, mate.
That was ZDNet Australia editor Munir Kataria there. We'll be right back after this.
Are you at risk of data leakage? How many portable storage devices are being used in your organisation? Download the PointSec Device Discovery Tool from pointsec.com/device-discovery-tool to identify removable devices connected to your computers and find out where you might be vulnerable.
Up next is this week's feature interview. I did this interview with Adam Boileau for a piece I wrote for The Age and Sydney Morning Herald newspapers. It ran in today's IT section. Adam is organising a security conference in Wellington, which is less formal than the sorts of big money security cons you often see at the fancy convention centres. It's a similar concept to Las Vegas's DEF CON conference or Sydney's RuxCon event, which sadly, as we mentioned in the intro, isn't running this year. RuxCon is on hold until 2008. Still, RuxCon's pause was one more reason for Boileau and his gang to get KiwiCon organised. Here's Adam telling us what KiwiCon is all about, and yes, Australians are welcome to make the trip over.
Well, it's going to be New Zealand's first hacker conference, right? We're aiming for something, you know, along the lines of DEF CON and RuxCon, you know, for the community, by the community, hopefully, you know, with, you know, good selection of kids and students and, you know, people from the industry, as well as, you know, maybe law enforcement, that sort of thing.
You've attended RuxCon a couple of times, and is the decision to not run RuxCon this year a reason that KiwiCon was launched?
It certainly helped give us some motivation. I mean, KiwiCon is something that comes up every time, you know, a bunch of Kiwis get together and you know, drink a few beers and talk about hacking. So yeah, we wanted to do it for a long time. But yeah, the fact that there doesn't look like there's going to be a RuxCon this year has helped motivate us some.
Do you expect that there'll be many Australians flying over to actually attend KiwiCon?
Well, we certainly hope so. We've got you know, a few of our friends that we've met at RuxCon, and you know, from working over there, that sound like they're going to come. So yeah, we would hope for you know, a bunch of Australians.
And what can we expect when we get over there?
Well, hopefully it'll be like RuxCon, but with less Australians. maybe more beer.
More beer than RuxCon. That'd be quite a challenge.
Well, it's, you know, we've got to have goals, right?
Are there going to be activities the same as RuxCon, sort of like, you know, capture the flag hacking competitions and chili eating?
We're not planning on a capture the flag, but we are going to be running a sort of a hacker quiz, like the one that the TISO guys ran at, I think, the first RuxCon.
So it's mostly going to revolve around technical presentations then?
Yeah, there's going to be technical presentations. There's been some talk of a field trip out to the Tangi Moana Echelon ground station, which is you know, a little way out of Wellington.
Well, that wouldn't be an officially acknowledged installation, would it?
Well, it depends who you ask, doesn't it?
Yeah. Okay. So a field trip to an Echelon ground station, that sounds incredibly geeky. Do you have to wear your Star Trek t-shirts to do it? Or?
Yeah, maybe some fake ears, yeah.
So you've chosen not to opt for corporate sponsorship in this instance. How much will you be charging for people to attend?
I believe the rate is going to be $50 at the door, or $30 if you don't have a job or you're a student.
What are the highlights in terms of technical presentations that you've already got teed up?
Well, we've got a bunch of interesting submissions so far. I think all the, you know, regular crew who've been, you know, the New Zealanders who've been presenting at RuxCon are probably going to turn up. I'm going to be presenting some work that I've been doing. It's all a little hush-hush at the moment.
So where is it being held? It's at the University of Wellington, is it?
Victoria University in Wellington, yes.
Victoria University in Wellington, okay.
Which, some of us who've been around the industry for a while may remember it as the birthplace of the stoned virus back in the DOS days.
Oh, there you go. Hallowed ground indeed.
Indeed, yes.
And the most important question, of course, is there a bar?
Well, there's plenty of bars in Wellington. There'll be, we'll definitely have to find the closest one and teach them how we do it.
Yeah, okay. So it's not like the UTS setup where people could actually have a drink in between sessions.
No, it's unfortunately we haven't been able to get quite as good a setup as the RuxCon dudes had.
Yeah,
it's a pity, but we'll do our best.
Now, how much do you think KiwiCon will be a social event, and how much do you think it'll actually be an event for people to further their skills?
Well, I mean, I think HackerCon's the best stuff always happens over the bar. I mean, the talks are interesting, but you know, I think the people you meet and the connections you make are always the things that last more than the technical presentations.
Yeah, it does have that sort of subculture get-together vibe to it, doesn't it? Well,
yeah, absolutely. And yeah. I mean, you know, those people who you meet are the ones that you will learn about the really new and interesting things from. You know, and the talks are always good fun, and there's always things to learn. But yeah, it's more about the people.
So how many presentations are we talking about here?
We're aiming for 2 days worth. At the moment, we've got a kind of a mix of length, so there'll be some kind of 40, 50-minute presentations, and then there's also going to be a bunch of kind of short 15-minute sort of lightning talks or presentations of tools. So there'll be, plenty of people talking.
And are you expecting any controversy?
Oh, well, we wouldn't mind a little.
good answer.
Always, helps with the publicity, but no, I mean, fundamentally, New Zealand's a very small community, and, you know, we all want to work together to improve the security of, you know, our applications and our critical infrastructure and on, you know, the networks on which we all rely. So no one wants to shit in anyone's patch, to use the vernacular.
How many tickets will be available?
We would be happy if we got, 100 people. We've got the capacity to do more like 150, maybe 200 if we push it in the venue. But I mean, to be honest, if we get up to 100 people, we'd be happy.
Yeah. Okay. So it's sort of a more low key, smaller event.
Yeah, well, I mean, New Zealand is a pretty small place. You know, we've got 4 million people and 40 million sheep, and we're not really expecting many sheep.
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends on whether turns up. That's another story. I'm just wondering, though, don't you think there's a bit of a risk that you could face a huge influx of Aussies who have been starved of their social event? I remember during the first RuxCon, there were teams of people turning up who'd hired cars and driven from Perth just to attend the event. So it doesn't seem too much of a stretch to me that people will be hopping on those cheap, you know, $400 return flights from Sydney to get over to KiwiCon.
Well, you know, if Aussies turn up, then, we'll just have to make them buy us beer and we'll find somewhere bigger. We'll scale up as we have to, I guess.
Yeah, okay. So when's the event actually being held?
17th and 18th November.
Okay, and are you hoping to make it a regular event?
We would like to, yes. Certainly we'll see how the first one goes. I mean, and, you know, we're all kind of con-organizing newbies, so we may, you know, screw it up wildly. But no, the intention is that we will, if it goes well, that we'll make it a regular event.
Also, Adam, I noticed that you have actually used the H word, whereas, you know, the RuxCon guys chose to use the words, you know, computer security enthusiast instead of actually busting out the H word for fear of, you know, today, tonight or a current affair turning up. You guys actually aren't scared of using the hacker word and taking your luck with the media.
Well, you know, if we get a bit of cheap controversy, then, well, you know, we're happy to media whore it up. And I think, if we get 80% bad publicity because we use the word hacker and 20% of people turn up because they're interested in finding out some more, then that's still a win.
Okay.
We're not afraid of getting arrested or anything. I don't see any trouble with using the word. And, you know, fundamentally, hacking is much more important than geeks and technology these days, right? The technology that we are hacking is what runs society. And if people don't push the boundaries, figure out how it works, demonstrate its flaws, then we're going to end up with a very, very brittle society.
Adam Boileau, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
KiwiCon organiser Adam Boileau there, who spoke to me by mobile phone from a very echoey lobby in New Zealand. Up next, it's time for our sponsor interview. Each week, we have a staffer from Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by CyberTrust, on the show. Now, Verizon Business pays our bills and makes this podcast possible, so it's the least we can do in return. This week, Adam Valentine is back on to talk about web content management systems and the risks they bring to organizations.
What you'll find is, at least in my line of work within computer forensics, in the last 4 months I've had several cases where both large-scale companies and as well government entities have been using content management systems without any degree of user authentication, essentially allowing bad guys to walk in the door. I hesitate to even call it a hack because there's no locks preventing people from getting in. If you'll ask a sysadmin, why wasn't there authentication here? He says, well, nobody knows about the site. The site is usually, www.companyname.com/admin. And, you'll see bad guys just going to that page and entering the back ends of websites. A lot of times have, private, personal information in and around payment card data and the state's social security information.
Let me ask you, Andrew, are they just defacing these pages? Are they stealing data, or are they actually planting malware onto those servers so that people who visit those sites are getting infected?
Well, let me give you a really, really good case example. This may be kind of lengthy, but it's worth it. There was a bank based out of the northeastern United States who maintained two websites completely separate from one another. The first one was just called www.bankname.com, and it was totally informational. There was absolutely no e-commerce into it at all, just information about loans, information about different accounts, branch locations, that sort of thing. Totally informational site. Another site that they had was, you know, mybankonline.com. Completely different site, developed by a different team, hosted at a different place. And this was the, you know, personalized e-commerce banking site, completely separate from the informational one. The way this worked was they had it set up so if you visited, you know, www.bankname.com, there's a link on the upper right-hand corner of the page that says, you know, take me to my online banking website.
So let me guess, they changed the link and they set up their own little login capture thing.
Absolutely. Over the course of about 3 days, systems administrators at this bank realized that nobody was visiting the e-commerce site. Where they usually see about, you know, 200 to 300 hits a day, they were seeing none. And it was just totally out of character. Click on that link that's on the bank site, and you see that it's at someplace, you know, www.something.tr/bankname.asp or whatever it was built.
And it really took them 3 days to notice that.
It took them 3 days to notice it, absolutely. Once you put in your account number and password, then it was like, oh, we're updating our system. Please give us your mother's maiden name, you know, your home address, any phone numbers you have, any payment cards that you have.
You'd think a financial institution would perhaps, you know, have a little bit more sense than this, though, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you, Andrew?
Absolutely, you would. And again, the way the bad guys got in was that there was on the informational site, the CMS was not protected by any degree of authentication at all. It was just www.banknames.com/admin, and then from there you could change content. So clearly, just somebody went in and redirected that link. It required no hacking, you know, technically speaking. Just a walk right in the door.
It's quite often the case, isn't it, that you know, people tend to get a little bit too focused on one part of the equation. In this case, I suppose the security staff are all busy worrying about their internet banking servers, when in actual fact they really needed to worry about their brochureware site as well, because it was directing a great deal of traffic towards their e-commerce service.
Yeah, it's a degree of complacency where, you know, if your systems work, you just sort of take a back seat and you don't mess with anything. You know, it works. Why do I need to mess with it? And I think that's the attitude that a lot of maybe systems administrators and developers just kind of become complacent. You know, once systems are up and running, there's no need to implement security controls because it works.
Yeah. Well, hopefully people out there who are listening might want to go and check with their marketing departments and make sure no one's getting cute with web CMSs.
Absolutely.
Okay, Andrew, thank you very much for your time again this week.
Thank you, sir.
That was Andrew Valentine there, a security consultant in Verizon Business Security Solutions Incident Response Unit. And that brings us to the close of another edition of Risky Business. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thank you for listening. Oh, and we're taking you out with a bit of upbeat blues this week, just for something different. Bye-bye.